This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Safety FM with Jay Allen. I hope everything is good and grand inside of your neck of the woods as we are hanging out on this Tuesday, January the 3rd of 2025. As you know, we are doing our thing. I know summer's right around the corner, depending on how you look at it. Summer's not really towards like the third week of June, but some people consider it summer if you're looking at it because kids are already out of school, depending on where you're located. So maybe we can look at it that way. So anyways, we're doing a throwback episode, and not really a throwback as you think that it's not happening now. It's a recording that I did when I was down. Well, I shouldn't say down because I'm in Florida. So when I was up in Banff, Calgary, Alberta, better saying, because I just screwed that up. But for Energy Safety Canada. Hanging out there in good old Banff. Man, it is a gorgeous place to be. There is no doubt there. So today we're going to listen to the presentation by Steve Scott, who's been on the show before. And in his little speech that he did, his presentation, he talks about learning to fail. And it goes over something along these lines. Many organizations have operated under the principle that zero incidents is the only acceptable outcome, believing every incident is preventable. Despite these efforts, serious injuries and fatalities still occur. So he's going to cover in his particular session the challenges, long-held safety beliefs, and explores a new approach on protecting workers. The session will introduce the first principles of human and organizational performance. Error is normal. So as he goes through the presentation at the very, very end, we'll add in the interview that him and I did right after he came off of the stage. So hang around for that. Anyways, this is Safety FM with Jay Allen, and here's a presentation by Steve Scott from Energy Safety Canada, the conference that occurred in Banff.
In safety, in my opinion, you woke up. You saw the system, the simulation, the structure that trained you to mistake compliance for care. Safety mutation. Information misdirection picks up where the signal fractured. Because the system didn't shut you down, it rebranded you. It packaged your voice. Sold your rebellion as a new initiative. And smiled while doing it. This isn't a manual. It's a decoded transmission about what happens when slogans replace stories, when safety becomes marketing, and when truth gets mirrored so perfectly, you forget it was ever yours. You'll see the mutation. Learning teams turned into theater. Zero harm turned into optics. And feedback turned into formatting. But the signal didn't die. It was redirected.
Safety Mutation is book two of the Signal Transmission Trilogy. Available now in print, Kindle, and audiobook. Narrated by the author Jay Allen, PhD. Because the system adapted. Now it's your move.
Thanks, and good morning. It's been kind of neat for me listening to Sean yesterday and then Jody just now talk about a lot of the same things I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to try to complement what they presented and talk to you about human and organizational performance, but through the lens of my experiences, first with Alcoa and then on working with other organizations by myself. So it's probably important to think about or for talk about a minute where we started. And if you don't know anything about Alcoa, you might have heard of a guy named Paul O'Neill. Paul O'Neill in 1987 became the CEO of Alcoa. And Paul O'Neill deserves all the credit for making safety a core value at Alcoa. But to the day he died, Paul O'Neill was still giving speeches and making videos and writing articles about how zero is the only acceptable outcome and every incident's preventable. That was deeply, deeply, deeply embedded in our DNA at Alcoa. So here's how that came across to me as a new worker at Alcoa. I'd been there, I started working at a smelter, an aluminum smelter in the state of Maryland in the U.S. near where I live. And I'd been there about 6 months. And I was working in a part of the plant we called the cast house, where we take molten aluminum and we alloy it, cast it into ingots that we cut and package and sell to customers. And I was using a steel stamp to mark a bunch of ingots one day. And sometimes those ingots, as they're being cast, they have a little jagged edge on the bottom of them. And I bumped my knee against the edge of one of those ingots, and I put a little cut on my knee. Now, since day one at the plant, what had I been told to do if there's any injury? Got to report it, anything, no matter how minor. So I went to my supervisor. I said, hey, I got a little cut on my knee. He sent me up to medical. I got a Band-Aid and went back to work. No biggie. Until the next day. And I got called into the office, and the general supervisor had a copy of the procedure for stamping ingots, and he pointed out to me that right on the procedure it says, look out for jagged edges on the ingots. And I was given a counseling for unsafe work performance. Now, I spent another 9.5 years as an hourly worker in that plant. You think I reported another injury?
No.
No. Not going to tell you I didn't have any, but I daggone sure didn't report them. So fast forward a few years. I became the superintendent of that department. And as superintendent, I still had that in my mind, that event that happened to me as a new employee. And I had this idea that, yeah, we can't accept people doing stuff that's bad. We got to be able to punish that, right? But we also should find a way to reward good stuff. We can't just be all stick and no carrot. So we put together this little thing in our department. If your crew goes 30 days without an injury, we'll buy you a free lunch. Right? Sounds good, right? On a Monday afternoon, I'm sitting in my office and my phone rings, and our plant safety manager said, hey, Steve, one of your guys is in the hospital. I don't even know about anything that happened. I said, what's going on? He starts telling me about it. Guy, I'll call him Dale. Dale gets off work, graveyard shift on Friday morning. He's due back in on daylight shift on Tuesday. At some point on Friday, Dale had poked his thumb on a little drip of aluminum that had frozen and formed like a little needle. Fairly common thing. He poked his thumb on it, didn't tell anybody, went home, woke up on Sunday with his hand all swollen and red, went to the hospital. They had to lance his hand, drain it, stitch it back up, and now we got a lost workday case. So when I get a chance to talk to Dale, I said, Dale, why didn't you report that? What do you think he told me? Man, we were due for a free lunch this week if we didn't have any injuries. I didn't want to ruin that for my whole crew. So this is the way we manage safety. This is the way we tried to get zero incidents. All right? And what we were really doing, I know now, was we were having zero incidents reported. That's what we were really after. So let me talk a little bit about that journey and how we got to where we got and some of the things we learned along the way. So I'm going to start out by showing you a picture here in a second. And when I show you this picture, what I want you to do is lock in your immediate gut reaction when you see it. Okay? Here we go. What do you see? Now, be really honest with me. How many of you look at that picture and your first reaction is, that's a bunch of crazy workers doing some stupid stuff? Is that your reaction? It's almost impossible not to have that immediate reaction. So you look at that picture and you say, that's clearly some workers who made bad choices. Now, if that's workers that made bad choices, what are we going to fix? And how do we do that? We do the name, blame, shame, retrain. We yell and scream. Maybe we issue discipline, suspend people, terminate people. Do you think those workers got up that morning and decided, hey, today we're going to go to work and we're going to do something really stupid that could get us killed? They came to work to do the job they were paid to do. And somehow they found themselves in a situation where they didn't have what they needed, so they got creative. So rather than look at this as workers who made bad choices, what if we look at this as workers who were given bad choices? Because I can almost guarantee you when you see situations like that, you're looking at a worker that was given a job to do and was not provided with the right tools, equipment, materials, training, supervision to do it successfully. And when workers find themselves in that position, very often what they do is they figure out a way to get it done. They don't throw their hands up and go home. They figure out a way to get it done. So what I want to think about is, how do I respond to that differently? So instead of asking the worker, why'd you do that? That's the wrong question. The question ought to be, how did I put a worker in a position where they felt they needed to do that in order to get their job done? Because I guarantee you, this is not workers who failed the organization. This is an organization that failed its workers. And being able to own that is a super, super powerful thing, not only in keeping people out of situations like that, but in getting workers more likely to tell us about when they get in those situations, that they're not being blamed. One of my favorite quotes around this topic, Mike Tyson, the boxer, says everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. I guarantee you those workers had a plan on how to take that tree down. And it didn't involve what you just saw. And then something happened. And they adapted. Does that ever happen in your workplace? More often than not, that's what we do. Okay? So that takes me into this conversation about work as imagined versus work as performed. And I'm going to guess most of you have seen this graph before, right? What's the black line? Work as imagined. So the black line is everything that we think defines how work is supposed to be done. This is everything from government regulations to your corporate policies and standards to your plant safety rules to your SOPs, your safe work instructions. It's the way the process engineer said the process is supposed to work. It's the way the equipment manufacturer said you're supposed to operate the equipment. This is everything that defines how work is supposed to happen, right? How often do we operate on that black line where we're doing everything 100% according to the procedures? I would say rarely, if ever. Why not? Yeah. The work environment's a pretty dynamic place, right? It's sometimes downright chaotic. And I read a white paper not long ago about complex systems. And one of the things I remember from that was this quote, every system always operates at a degraded state. No matter how new it is, how modern it is, how well designed it is, there's something out there that's not working exactly the way it's supposed to. Do you agree with that? Do your procedures take that into account? The workers take that into account. So we give them all these rules, policies, procedures, standards, and then we throw them into this dynamic, chaotic workplace where they have to adapt to all this stuff that's happening, and so they end up doing that, right? You heard Steve yesterday morning talk about drift into failure. That's what that is, right? And that blue line is not workers that are dumb or lazy or they're not conscientious, or they don't care about doing a good job. That blue line is workers who are fantastic adaptive problem solvers. They're getting punched in the mouth repeatedly, and they keep bouncing back and figuring out a way to get their work done. Right? And one of the things we see over and over again is that over time, that blue line drifts further and further away from the black line. Give you a quick example. I got a specific task to do, and it's about a 10-minute walk from my shop, and it requires a special tool. So we always leave that special tool at the site of that task. So I walk over to where I need to do that task, and that special tool's gone. So I figure out a way to do that task without the special tool. And I get done, and I realize, wow, that was quicker. It was easier. I didn't get hurt. I got the task done. What am I likely to do next time? I'm going to do the same thing, because we humans are pretty lazy creatures. We will do things the easy way unless we have a good reason not to. Now, my coworkers see that. What are they likely to do? They're going to do the same thing because they're lazy humans too. So pretty soon everybody's doing it that way. And if that deviation goes undetected or uncorrected, we've just established a new norm a little bit away from the black line. And that happens over and over and over and over again. Make sense? So that blue line, it's kind of a good news, bad news story. The good news is workers are really, really good at this. If you said we're rarely, if ever, on the black line, that means we're almost always on the blue line, right? They don't get hurt every day. They don't destroy equipment every day. They don't make defective product every day. They tend to be able to run our sites successfully while they're on the blue line, because humans are really good adaptive problem solvers. The problem is, the bad news, is that there are these hazards that exist in the workplace. The black line is designed to keep the workers well separated from those hazards, right? The blue line's not. The blue line's designed to get work done. And those hazards aren't static. They don't always show up at the same place at the same level every time. They're dynamic. They ebb and flow. Sometimes they pop up unexpectedly. And when that hazard pops up unexpectedly and encounters that worker out on the blue line adapting in real time to this dynamic work environment trying to get his job done, that's where stuff happens, right? So let me ask you a couple questions about this. Number one, do you think this is a pretty good description of how work really happens? Do you think that's real? Okay. Question number two, is the blue line necessary? Could you operate your sites if we had to be on that black line 100% following every rule, policy, procedure, standard to the letter? I don't think we could. I don't think we could. I think we depend on workers doing this in order to keep our sites running. So the next question is, when do we usually acknowledge that the blue line exists? After an event, right? And then what's the first question we ask? Why weren't you on the black line? Why weren't you following a procedure? Right? Here's what that sounds like to me when I was an operator. This is what I do all day, every day in order to get my job done and keep your plant running. You know this is what I do all day, every day in order to keep your plant running. And I know you know this is what I do all day, every day in order to keep your plant running. And we all pretend it's not happening as long as the plant's running well. And then as soon as something goes wrong, you want to yell at me for doing that. That's what we do, right? Let me talk about two parts of this graph or this picture. This is where traditional safety management usually focuses most of its attention, that gap between the black line and the blue line. We try to minimize that deviation between work as imagined and work as performed. We focus on compliance, right? And we've got all kinds of ways to do that. Our auditing process is usually compliance focused. We go out and we audit people against the standards. Our observation programs, we go out and watch people and see if they're working according to the SOP. We try to minimize that gap between the black line and the blue line. And then when we find something we don't like, is that ever a good experience for the worker? Or is it mostly a bad experience for the worker? It's mostly a bad experience. I mentioned for a while I was a superintendent in that department we called the cast house. And I was the guy in that plant that when something happened, even if it was a near serious near miss or something like that, and I found out someone didn't do what they were supposed to do, I was the one that issued discipline. I was recognized for that. I was rewarded for that. I was seen as being really good at holding people accountable. What kind of behavior you think that drove in my organization? People quit telling me stuff. People hid stuff from me because they didn't trust me enough to tell me because they knew how I was going to respond. And that was driven by that focus on compliance. Okay? Human and organizational performance lives in this gap between the blue line and the red line. I don't think the blue line's ever going to go away. So I don't think our goal should be to eliminate the blue line. I think our goal should be to help workers be safe and successful while they're on the blue line. And if we want workers to be safe and successful while they're on the blue line, what's the first thing we have to do? What do I have to do if I want to help workers be safe and successful while they're on the blue line? I got to know about the blue line, right? I got to know where it exists and why it exists and what deviations and workarounds and shortcuts and adaptations they're making. And if they think I'm going to yell and scream and punish them when they do that, they're not going to tell me about it. I lived through that in my time working in a smelter. Okay? So human and organizational performance is very much about knowing how work really happens, helping workers become safe and successful or remain safe and successful while they're in this chaotic work environment, adapting in real time, trying to get their work done. So let's talk about human and organizational performance just a little bit, what it is. And I'll tell you my journey with human and organizational performance. When we first started this with Alcoa, I first got exposed to it in about 2009. And back then we called it HPI. Anybody remember those days? And it was largely focused on error management, identifying error likely situations and using tools to reduce our error rate, right? Who do you think we applied that to? Leaders or workers? Workers. This was a thing we did to workers. You need to be able to identify error likely situations and use these tools to reduce your error rate. So what do you think happened after an incident? What kind of questions did we ask?
Why did you miss that error?
Yeah, did you, why didn't you identify that error trap? It's clear as day to me that you were distracted and you were probably, you know, exhausted and you had all this other stuff going on. Why didn't you recognize that and stop? So down the road, we saw these five principles when we did our initial HPI training, but we focused on what do we need the workers to do differently? Because they're the ones that get hurt, right? Not us. When I really started focusing on these five principles, who do we want to embrace these five principles initially? Leaders. This is all about how we behave as leaders. And that was a hard sell for us because we had some very experienced, very long-tenured leaders that continued to think workers were the problem. So we really had to start pushing this idea that it all begins with us. And it starts with the idea that we have to accept the fact that error is normal. Error is not something that happens to people that are not as smart as me, not as dedicated as me, not as conscientious as me. Error is a normal thing that happens to humans. We make errors, we make mistakes, we deviate. Okay? If you accept the fact that error is just a perfectly, boringly normal thing for humans to do, everybody okay with that? Does it make any sense to say that an event was caused by human error? If it's a boringly normal thing that all humans do and we're never going to eliminate it, and we say that an event was caused by human error, what are you going to fix? You got nothing to fix because you're not going to find a human that won't make errors. So if we accept the fact that error is normal, What we then have to do is we have to build systems that anticipate workers will make errors and allow them a chance to recover before something bad occurs. Okay? You all have on your highways the little rumble strip along the side of the road when your tire goes over and it makes all that noise and vibration. That's not there to keep you from running off the road, right? That's there to tell you you have run off the road. Get back on the road before you hit the guardrail. That's what we want. We want to anticipate that people will make errors and have enough resiliency to recover from that before something bad happens. So we have to give up on this idea that error is something we should blame and punish people for. I made the comment earlier that this was my go-to when I was a superintendent. Something bad happened. I dug into it. I found out where someone didn't do what they were supposed to do. I issued them discipline. And I can go back now and I can think of some very specific examples where something happened and people wouldn't tell me about it, and I either had to spend an enormous amount of time trying to figure it out, or I never did figure it out because they didn't trust me. I created that, okay? So saying that blame fixes nothing, I think actually understates the problem. Blame stops us from learning. If people think they're going to be blamed and punished for doing something, they're not going to tell us about it, okay? So rather, we should be focused on learning. Learning is a deliberate choice. To be really good, organizations that are really good at learning didn't get that way by accident. They made deliberate choices to prioritize learning. Prioritize learning after events, and prioritize learning from normal work. One of my favorite examples of what that looks like in practice is commercial aviation. Commercial aviation in a lot of countries today have programs for error and deviation reporting. In the U.S., we call it an aviation safety action program. It has different names in different countries. But basically, this is sponsored by our regulatory body, the Federal Aviation Administration. An aviation safety action program is a contract between the people, the companies that do all the work, and the workers that actually perform it. And this touches pilots and flight crews and air traffic controllers and the people that are ground handlers, the maintainers of the aircraft. They almost all work under one of these programs. And it basically says, if I make a mistake, an error, or even a violation, and I report it accurately and promptly, and it does not involve things like criminal activity and substance abuse, I won't be punished. So commercial aviation has made a deliberate choice to focus on learning, and in order to do that, they had to create a safe organization or a safe culture where people were free to tell us about those things that we probably didn't want to hear about. That's what it looks like to make a deliberate choice on learning, deliberate focus on learning. It doesn't happen by accident. And when things do happen, like those guys I showed you at the beginning, the first picture up in the tree on the ladders, we tend to focus on the behavior, right? It's the easiest thing for us to focus on. You shouldn't have done that. What we really should be trying to understand is the context that drove that behavior. What were the conditions that those workers found themselves in that led to that behavior? Because if we focus on the behavior, what's our response going to be? We're going to go back to try to fix the worker. Name, blame, shame, retrain, right? We may be able to change the behavior of one worker for a short period of time. Changing behavior is really hard, really unreliable. If we can change the conditions that those workers find themselves in, we have a much better chance of successfully creating better context, not just for that worker, but for anyone else in that situation. Because context is what drives their behavior. And then finally, how we respond as leaders matters. Todd Conklin has a quote I like. He says, when you hear about a bad event, you have a choice. You can blame and punish, or you can learn and improve. You can't do both. So the immediate reaction we provide people after an event, the words that come out of our mouth, the look on our face, sends a really clear signal to the audience which of those two options I'm going with. Am I looking for who to blame, or am I looking for what can I learn? So as leaders, if we embrace those principles and we use those principles to guide or to drive our actions, that's how we implement or integrate human and organizational performance. It's much, much more about what we do as leaders than what we want the workers to do differently. Now, every time I talk about this, right about this point in the presentation, somebody will ask the question. Now, I jumped, I missed a slide. Take a minute and read that. Error's normal. Give me a break. How many of you read those first three lines wrong and you're still trying to figure out what you read wrong? It's not because you can't read. It's because that's the way our brain works. When it sees something that's really close to what it wants to see, it defaults to what it wants to see. Not because we're dumb or lazy or can't read or aren't interested or aren't conscientious. It's normal. Error is extremely boringly normal. So this is where I always get the question, well, then what about accountability? If our goal is to learn and improve, not to blame and punish, does accountability just go away? And I'm going to say that as leaders, we have a legal, an ethical obligation to maintain standards in the workplace, right? So accountability doesn't go away. I want you to think differently about how we define accountability. If you ask your workers in your company, tell me about accountability here at work, what are they likely to tell you about? What are they going to tell you if you ask them about accountability here at work? They're probably going to tell you about your disciplinary process. If I do this, I get a verbal warning, and I get a written, then I get a final warning, and I get suspended, and then I get terminated, right? We have taught people, especially at work, that accountability means consequences. If you look up the definition of accountability in a dictionary, it's going to say something like a willingness to take responsibility and to account for my actions. There's nothing in there about consequences. That's something we made up. So if we define accountability that way, it's taking responsibility and accounting for my actions. Here's what I did, here's why I did it. Is that something we can force people to do? So this whole idea of being able to hold people accountable starts to fall apart. Because I can't force people to tell me what they did and why they did it. All right? And I know the other option doesn't work, where we have accountability versus punishment, because I tried that and I know it doesn't work. So what do? I really love this quote by Decker in one of his books. He says, our challenge is to create a culture of accountability that encourages learning. Every step we take towards accountability should serve that goal. Every step that does not serve that goal should be avoided. That's what commercial aviation has done. With those aviation safety action programs, they have tried to create a culture where reporting things is almost automatic. I found out, when I first started thinking about this, I was looking for some data on how well this works. And I found an article written by a person in the U.S. who was the president of an organization for charter pilots. And he said in a two-year period, members of his organization reported about 7,000 events through their aviation safety action program. 90% of them, 6,300 times, that report was single-sourced. Only one person saw it happen, which means they probably could have gotten away without reporting it. But they've created a culture where reporting becomes almost automatic because there's no fear associated with it. That's what we want to create. We want to create a culture of accountability that encourages learning. And if what we're doing is not encouraging learning, We need to seriously avoid it. Okay? So go back to principle number one yet again. Error is normal. I'll ask again, are we okay with that? That error is normal? It doesn't happen to bad people, dumb people, lazy people. It happens to humans. Can't get rid of it. Is zero the goal? Is every incident preventable? As long as we have humans in our workplace and those humans make errors, I don't see how we can prevent every incident from occurring. So I don't think we come across as credible if we say zero is the goal. Now this, during my time at Alcoa, this conversation would have probably gotten me fired. Because that idea that zero is the only acceptable outcome and every incident preventable was just gospel in Alcoa. But we kept having really bad stuff happen. So the way I like to think about it is, it's almost a moral obligation for us to not want to hurt people, right? But what happens when zero becomes the measuring stick to define good versus bad, success versus failure, reward versus punishment? We quit telling people stuff. We start covering stuff up. One of the plants I used to visit when I worked for Alcoa is a big plant in South America, a big chemical refinery. And I don't know if any of you have ever been in an alumina refinery, but it's a really messy place. There's millions of gallons of fluid running through it. It's got a pH of about 13.5, so you'll get chemical burns if you touch it. And it also operates at about 200 degrees Fahrenheit, so you'll get a thermal burn on top of that. And this material scales up all the pipes and valves and everything, so the workers actually carry around a sledgehammer with them that they use to open and close valves. So there's lots and lots and lots of ways to get hurt in an alumina refinery. This was one of our larger ones. This was about 2,000 Alcoa employees, and on any given day, maybe 3,000 contractors on site at this refinery. And they would go 2, 3, 4 years in a row with zero injuries. Not even a first aid case. But about every 7 years, they had a fatality. I can remember being at that site one time, and I'm walking around the plant, and I had to use the restroom, so I duck into the men's room, and I notice hanging on the wall in the men's room, there's a first aid kit. So I take a peek at it. I'm nosy, and half the stuff in the first aid kit's missing. So now, every time I pass a men's restroom, I walk in and I check out the first aid kit, and they've all got stuff missing out of them. So at the end of the visit, I ask my host, I say, hey, tell me about the first aid kits in the bathrooms. And he was really proud of it. He said, well, that was an employee suggestion. They asked us to put up these first aid kits in the bathrooms. And I said, but they're all missing stuff. How do you keep them stocked? He said, well, the vendor comes in and restocks them every couple weeks. I said, wait a minute. Explain this to me. You have not reported a first aid case in more than 2 years, but you have to have a vendor come restock the first aid kits every couple weeks. What do you think we found out? I had a conversation with the plant manager, and he said, we have a really good reward system for safety, but we also have a 2 strikes and you're out policy. If you get injured the first time, you're probably going to get disciplined. If you get injured the second time, you're gone. So now if I get a cut on my hand or I get a small caustic burn on my leg, am I going to tell anybody? I just go in the bathroom, grab the first aid kit, cover it up, and go back to work. That's what happens when we're driven by things like zero, the desire to get zero. When it becomes the measuring stick of success or failure, reward or punishment, that's the kind of behavior we drive. Everybody's seen this pyramid, right? Jody talked about it a little bit in her presentation. Heinrich's pyramid. where we got fatalities at the top and then lost work days and medical treatment. I think the way we've looked at this pyramid in safety management, I know we did at Alcoa, we looked at that pyramid and we said exactly what Jody talked about. If I can shrink the bottom of that pyramid, I'm less likely to get to the top. So if I have fewer injuries, I'm less likely to have a fatality. And that drove our thinking for years and years and years and years. But the data says it's wrong. There's 10 years worth of U.S. workplace safety data from our Bureau of Labor Statistics. And if you look at that blue line, that's a good news story. That's a significant reduction in total recordable injuries over a 10-year period. If you look at that orange line, that's the bad news. That's the fatality rate. And it's flat for 10 years. We're still killing people at the same rate that we were 10 years ago. If you look at the bars is the raw number of fatalities. And look how many years that bar keeps going up. So we're having fewer injuries, but more fatalities. How does that happen? Now you may look at that and say, well, that's US data. They do dumb stuff with TRIR and you know they're not that smart anyway. I mean, we elected Donald Trump twice. The International Labor Organization collects data from about 40 countries. And since everybody has different definitions and reporting requirements, the ILO simply looks at fatal or non-fatal. So for every injury that's reported, either it was fatal or not. And then they translate into that into rates per 100,000 workers. And you see the same trend. The blue dotted line, non-fatal injury rate. Significant improvement over 10 years. The red dotted line is the fatality rate, and it's flat. And I could show you several more data sets that show the same thing. We're having fewer injuries and more fatalities. How's that possible? What drives that? And Jody touched on it in her presentation. I think there's two main causes. Number one, there's still a lot of places where it's really easy to fire people for being injured on the job. And even in countries like Canada and the U.S. where we've made it more difficult to do that, we have found a lot of really subtle, under-the-table ways to discourage people from reporting stuff. Right? Jody showed you the big sign at the front gate that says, days since the last injury. Right? The rule is the bigger that number gets, the less likely it is I'll report something. Because I don't want to be the person that makes it go back to zero. We do things like we make them go into the, someone has a minor injury, we make them go sit down with the safety department and fill out a 45-minute form about what happened, right? Then we make them talk about it in the next toolbox meeting the next day about what they did stupid that got them injured. So we have some really subtle ways to discourage people from reporting. And every time we do that, we lose an opportunity to learn. There's a risk, there's a hazard out there that goes unmanaged. And then the other thing Jody also talked about is if we're driven by this desire to achieve zero incidents, or we're driven by metrics like total recordable rate, we're gonna automatically focus on high frequency, low consequence events like slips, trips and falls, hand and finger injuries, strains and sprains. And every minute we're doing that, we're not focused on low frequency, high consequence events, the things that cause people to be seriously injured or killed. And I think that's why we see that phenomenon over and over again of fewer injuries and more fatalities. So at Alcoa, we tried to get away from this. We started measuring something we called DART. Any of you ever heard of the metric DART? Stands for days away, restricted, or transferred. It looks at the severity of the injury rather than the treatment. So basically, if I'm injured to the extent that I'm unable to perform the major functions of my job for two consecutive shifts, that's a DART injury. So we thought we're better than that. We're gonna quit looking at this TRIR stuff and we'll start measuring DART. I'll tell you how that worked out here in a minute. But what we learned over and over again is expecting zero incidents is expecting perfection. It's expecting our people to be perfect, our process to be perfect, our equipment to run perfectly, the customer to be predictable, the work environment to be agreeable. It's expecting everything to be perfect. But we know that in complex systems, failure is normal. It's going to happen. The other thing we learned was incident prevention is different than serious injury and fatality prevention. And one of the things we saw at Alcoa, and I've seen this in a lot of other companies, is that when we're fixated on zero, or we're fixated on driving down lagging indicators like total recordable rate or DART rate, we put an enormous emphasis on preventing incidents from occurring, which isn't a bad thing. We don't want to have incidents. And we have all these systems that serve to help us prevent incidents from occurring. Our rules, our standards, our policies, our auditing process, a lot of the stuff we taught with human performance in the beginning about error reduction tools and things like that, we're largely geared toward preventing incidents from occurring, which again is good, it's useful. But what we found was we weren't prepared to protect the worker when incidents occurred because our focus was on preventing the incident from happening. So we realized that we had to do both. Another thing Jody mentioned was we learned the hard way the things that hurt people are different than the things that kill people. So one of the things I'd encourage you to do is stop asking if and start asking when. Stop asking people what's gonna protect you when or if that happens. Because when I hear the word if, many of us as humans have a pretty strong positivity bias. It won't happen to me. I'm smart, I'm experienced, I'm good at my job, I know what I'm doing. It won't happen to me. So force the issue. Ask the question, hey, what's the worst thing that could possibly happen in this job you're getting ready to do? If you knew with 100% certainty it was going to happen to you today, what keeps you from being seriously injured or killed? And is it enough? So that's a really different strategy. This was a hard one for us at Alcoa. It's a deliberate change in strategy. Rather than think we can prevent every incident from occurring, we're going to constantly keep challenging ourselves and our workers. Where's the next incident going to occur? Where's the next significant failure going to happen? And are we ready for it? Do we have enough capacity in the system that we can take this event without somebody being seriously injured or killed? And again, that conversation was almost sacrilege in Alcoa. But what we were doing wasn't working. So we had to start thinking about what do we want to do differently? Safety's, and this is another Conklin quote that most of you have probably heard before. Safety's not the absence of incidents. It's the presence of capacity. Now, I first heard Conklin say that at a conference. I think it was in 2014. It made sense to me. I took a picture of his slide because I thought it made sense. Really got driven home to me about a year later. So at the time I went to that conference, Alcoa was in the middle of this period, which was the biggest, the longest period in our history, fatality-free. We had just gone, for the first time in the history of the company, we had gone a calendar year without a fatality anywhere in the company, from our co-employees or our contractors. So we were doing really good, right? We were in the middle, well into the second year of this. Until September 15th, 2015, where we had a fatality at one of our plants. Now, if you'd asked anyone in Alcoa at the time, where's the next fatality going to occur, nobody would have named this plant. It was one of our most modern plants, lots of automation, really stable, engaged, talented workforce, good leadership, had the lowest total recordable rate in Alcoa, had the lowest DART rate in Alcoa. So the way we traditionally looked at safety, they were the safest plant in Alcoa. But on September 15, 2015, in the cast house at this plant, there was a gentleman named Emmanuel Boyer, who was doing a super boring routine task. This is something he did 33 or 34 times a day, and he'd been doing it for more than 20 years. He used an overhead crane to pick up a big crucible of molten aluminum from one side of the building, and he was walking across the floor to put that molten aluminum in a furnace. And at the same time Emmanuel was doing that, there was another worker doing a really boring routine job. He was on a forklift, and he set down a steel hopper that had scrap in it, and he backed out from under the hopper, and when he did, he struck and killed Emmanuel Boyer. When I got the phone call, one of my peers called me to tell me about that incident, and when he told me what happened, I remember saying, that's exactly what Conklin was talking about in that quote. No matter how long it had been since they had an incident, no matter how good their lagging indicators were, on that day, at that moment, in that task, we had a person on foot working in close proximity to mobile equipment. There's no capacity for failure. We're relying on those two people to be perfect. We're relying on the person on foot to always know the forklift's coming and the person in the forklift to always see the person on foot. There's no capacity for failure. And that's the way we had to start thinking about safety. Watch this video, short video, there's no sound. Watch this video and think about it in terms of capacity for failure in this system. Did you see how slowly that forklift was moving? I think you can make an assumption that that aisleway was designed for forklifts. That's probably how most of that material gets on and off those pallet racks. I don't know how old that warehouse was. I don't know how long it had been there. But you can probably assume that forklifts drive up and down that aisleway maybe hundreds of times a day. But one time, a forklift moving really, really slowly bumps into a pallet rack, and that's the result. That's a really fragile system where there is no capacity for failure. They're relying on the forklift operators to be perfect and never, ever bump into the pallet racks. Now watch this video and think about capacity for failure. Watch this little timer in the bottom left corner of the screen. That little car you see has a doctor in it and an emergency responder. It showed up in about 14 seconds. About 15 seconds, you had a fire extinguisher going. About 25 seconds, you had a second one going. And there's the driver climbing over the rail. They estimate that car hit the wall at 192 kilometers an hour. And the driver withstood the 67 G-forces, 67 times the force of gravity, when that car decelerated instantly to zero. And the driver got out of that car with second-degree burns on his hands and a sprained ankle. That was the total extent of his injuries. That's a Formula One race car. If all I wanted to do is win races, I would probably build that car as light as I could possibly make it. Because every ounce of weight I add to it does something I don't want. And then I would tell the driver, hey, you guys, you're the best drivers in the world. Be careful. Don't wreck. Oh, and win the race. But that's not what Formula One does. Formula One mandates the construction of that car to the point that there is 100% certainty that every single time it goes on the track, it will slam into a wall and burst into flames. How do I protect the driver when that happens? Not if it happens, when it happens. And it's not just the car. It's the clothes the driver's wearing. It's the helmet that's on his head. It's the emergency responders. That whole system works together to create capacity so that when a car slams into the wall and bursts into flames, the driver has an excellent chance of surviving that. And that's the way we need to think about safety. So how do we do that? How do we create capacity? You've heard Jody speak about it earlier, about managing critical controls. And this is the process that we fell into at Alcoa when we started looking at doing the same stuff harder isn't getting it. What do we want to do differently? So critical risk management was developed by ICMM, International Council of Mining and Metals, started in Western Australia with some of the big mining companies there. And basically, I like to describe it as a systematic, a structured approach to creating, measuring, and sustaining capacity. All right? And it starts with this laser focus on serious injury and fatality prevention. Because we've already said that the things that hurt people are different than the things that kill people. Now, one of the first people to do research in this field was a guy named Tom Krause. And Tom Krause looked at the incident data from a bunch of big organizations, including Alcoa. And what he said was, only about 21% of your incidents have the potential, the credible potential to cause serious injury or fatality. The other 79% lack sufficient energy to where that would be an expected outcome. And here's one of the important things I got out of Krause's research. Everything we do at the bottom of that pyramid and outside of that SIF triangle, that 79% of incidents that don't have enough energy to where serious injury or fatality is a likely outcome, slips, trips, falls, hand and finger injuries, twisted ankles, sore backs, everything we do to prevent or mitigate those type of events is not going to prevent the next serious injury or fatality. But if we're focused on zero or driving down lagging indicators, that 79% is where we're going to put an awful lot of our attention, right? So it all starts with, this whole process starts with changing your outlook, changing your thinking about what's the thing you're most desperately trying to avoid. In the literature, they call it the material unwanted event. So I found this example in a newspaper. They're doing some construction in the middle of a city, and they dropped a crane load right in the middle of the road. And the article says, although the load landed in the middle of the road, nobody was hurt because we stopped pedestrians from coming down the sidewalk, and we stopped cars from driving down the road while we were moving a crane load. So here's a question. Is that a success or a failure? Depends how you define safety, doesn't it? If you define safety as the absence of incidents, that's a failure. Dropped a crane load. If you define safety as the presence of capacity, that's a success. We weren't just lucky nobody was standing there. They stopped pedestrians, stopped cars, and in doing so created enough capacity so that when we dropped a crane load, we didn't kill anybody. So if our goal is to prevent serious injuries and fatalities, I don't care if we drop a crane load every single day, as long as we make sure nobody's under it when we drop it. That's the thing we got to wrap our heads around, okay? So then we start thinking about in our work, what are the hazards that we deal with every day that we've been unable to eliminate that have the most likelihood to cause that type of injury? And these are just six that are really common in industrial environments. There's probably some that are very particular to the work you do, but it's not every hazard. It's this small set of hazards. And then it becomes a step-by-step process. We identify controls. We identify which of those controls we're going to categorize as critical controls. And then we aggressively manage and measure and sustain, implement and sustain the effectiveness of those critical controls. We have to identify what are the things that could erode their effectiveness. How do we counter that with training and procedures and auditing and observation? And then ultimately, how do we verify in the moment not the presence of controls, but the effectiveness of those critical controls? This is how we create capacity to prevent serious injuries and fatalities. It's a structured approach, takes a lot of work, but it pays off. Y'all remember this plane crash that happened in Toronto just a few months ago? How many of you looked at that and you said, man, those people are really lucky? I did. And then I'm sitting there watching CNN one morning, and they had a aviation safety expert on there, and he said that airplane did exactly what it was designed to do. In the past, those planes, they've had many crashes where those planes made a hard landing, one of the wings hit the ground, and the thing tumbled wing over wing and ripped the fuselage to shred and killed almost everybody on board. So they started designing the plane so that the wings would break away when they started tumbling. They improved the seats in the airplanes. They made them a lot less comfortable, but they're designed to absorb the impact and to stay in place in an impact. Everybody in the plane had their seatbelts on. The flight crew did a fantastic job of getting everybody out of that plane quickly, and the emergency responders showed up and suppressed the fire so that everybody made it out of that crash alive. That wasn't luck. That's capacity. Okay? That whole system created capacity that allowed those people to survive that plane crash. And that's what we're looking for. So let me give you one last example. It's a different way of looking at risk. I took this picture at an Alcoa plant years ago. I was driving to an offsite meeting with the whole corporate safety team was having an offsite meeting. We're driving there. I'm in a car full of safety people. We drive past these guys working on a roof, and somebody says, hey, stop. And we sit there looking at it and talking about it. I got a car full of safety people, and the very first thing they start talking about is, are they in compliance? I'm not a career safety person. I don't know all the rules, policies, and procedures for working on a roof, but I'm in a car with three other people that do. And as best we could tell, they were doing everything our policies at that time required of them. The ladder was tied off, that doorway was barricaded, the guy on top is putting up flagging, he has a harness. If you look close, you can see his lanyard trailing out. There's a cable installed up on the roof that they attach their fall protection to. So as best we can tell, they're doing everything they're supposed to. What's the obvious hazard? Fall from heights, right? Where are they at greatest risk? At the top of the ladder, because their fall protection anchor point is up on the roof. So at the top of the ladder, either going up or coming down, they don't have their lanyard attached to anything. What's the worst thing that could happen? Somebody falls off the top of that ladder, right? When that happens, what's the control that keeps them from being seriously injured or killed? There's nothing. So is it safe? They're in compliance. Is it safe? And that's the difference between compliance and safety. Compliance is all those rules, policies, procedures that many of us don't even know. Safety is, I know that's a hazard that has a credible potential to kill me. I need a critical control in place to protect me when that happens. That's how we look at risk. Okay? What we really want to do is balance incident prevention with serious injury and fatality prevention. The work we do to prevent those high-frequency, low-consequence events is different than the work we do to prevent those low-frequency, high-consequence events. We have to do both, but we have to recognize that it's two different bodies of work. All right? So quick summary, error is normal. People are going to make mistakes, they're going to deviate. They're almost always successful when they do it, and they almost always do it with good intentions. Focusing on zero or reducing those lagging indicators aren't going to make us the safest or safer workplace. They're also not going to ensure a reduction in serious injuries and fatalities. Focus on serious injury and fatality prevention. Plan for failure, create capacity to fail safely. Celebrate successful failures. When you get that phone call that says, we just dropped a crane load, we had the whole vertical drop zone isolated, nobody was there, nobody got hurt, take a minute to celebrate that. And then look at it as a fantastic opportunity for learning. Okay? Last thing I'll leave you with. Any Ted Lasso fans in the crowd? I was binge watching Ted Lasso when I was recovering for some surgery a while back, and he said something in one episode that describes who we want to be. Be curious, not judgmental. Be curious, be open-minded, ask questions, listen to other people's opinions, hear what they have to say, understand their point of view. Don't become judgmental. The minute we become judgmental, we quit learning.
Okay, Steve Scott just came off the stage here at Energy Safety Canada. First off, let me ask the important question. What do you think about this venue? I mean, I'm so in love with
it. This is amazing. It's my first time in Banff. It's a beautiful place, nice hotel. And Energy Safety Canada is putting on a fantastic conference.
Like, I try to describe this place to people, and it's I just can't describe it. It's like you're in a picture. I've heard that term before, yeah. And it's like, that sounds like BS, but when you take a look around, it's like,
I can't
even envision what it is. So you just came out of your presentation, a lot of good stuff coming out, talking about a little bit of everything. So I wanted to pick up, because there were some questions that came out through the crowd that we weren't able to complete, so I just want to make sure that we're able to come over some of these. You had somebody that was asking, should we try moving the black line to meet the blue line or constantly reset and establish the black line?
So I think very often the blue line is workers that have found a better way to do the job. And if that's the case, we should evaluate that against cost, quality, time, safety. And if it really is a better way to do the job, we certainly should capture that and document it and integrate it into our processes and stuff like that. But that's going to be a constant evolution because things are always changing. The workers are always coming up with better ideas. They're always having to create workarounds and adaptations. So it's a constant iteration, which all starts with understanding the blue line. We have to be able to the workers have to be able to trust us enough to talk to us about the blue line so that we know, is that a better way to do that, or is that setting us up for something we need to think about?
Well, I mean, do you take a look back and go from time to time that we're actually developing systems, but there's no involvement from the employees when the black line is being created?
Exactly.
And so, is it the conversations that need to be had with the experience of jobs on the field opposed to the, and I'm not picking on corporate people, of course, but the people that are sitting in the office going, hey, this is how it should be done.
Yeah. I always ask the question when I'm talking about this in a small group, what's the difference between a shortcut and a process improvement?
And so they said,
if I'm cynical, a process improvement is something the manager or the process engineer comes up with. A shortcut is something the worker comes up with.
That normally works better than what was laid out.
Normally works better than what they did, yeah. Because very, very often, like you said, the process engineers, the managers, the leaders have this belief that they are the experts on the process and on the work that is part of that process. And what they need to understand is, number one, that process is imperfect, and those imperfections are always changing, which means the workers are always adapting to that in order to get their work done. And those adaptations are the things that we need to be really aware of so that we have an opportunity to either capture it as a better way of doing it or intervene and say, hey, we've got to make sure we look out for this or we guard ourselves against that.
So when you look at something like that, what do you think the intervals should be? What should be the intervals where these discussions are being had with the upper management of, hey, we've determined this is a better way of doing this?
I think that should be, those conversations should be happening every day. With supervisors, leaders, managers, engineers talking to workers about work. And when you see something that is, wow, this really is a better way of doing it. We've talked to all the operators. They all believe it's a better way of doing it. We don't believe it's going to hurt cost, productivity, efficiency, effectiveness, safety. We should document that. And then whatever change management process we have to make sure that we have considered all those things, we've documented it, we've communicated it, we've updated all our standards, we've updated our training materials, then that stuff falls in. So I think the thing we have to think about is, if we're thinking about frequency, is the juice worth the squeeze?
Okay.
Right? Is this change, is this improvement significant enough that I need to go through all that effort to validate it and integrate it and go through the change management and put it into our process?
Because you know automatically the moment you start seeing change management, people start freaking out inside of companies. It's like, right. hey, let's take a look at this.
Now, but the thing we have to realize is that change is happening, whether we run it through our change management process or not. That change has happened.
Yeah, it's happening within the organization if it has documented or not. Now, here's another question that came in. It says, what strategies or tool are easy to start with and for LFNW.
LFNW.
Yeah.
Learning from normal work.
Okay, there we go. I'm glad you got it because I was like, this acronym has thrown me off.
I think the simplest thing, I love what Brent Sutton and those guys came up with the four Ds. Mm-hmm. It takes that conversation and makes it into a, you know, almost a slogan that's easy to remember. So what I encourage people is leaders at every level, carve out 15 minutes of your day, go find a worker and ask them what's dumb, different, difficult, and dangerous. Have a short conversation with them about what's dumb, different, difficult, and dangerous. And then take what you learned and use that to make those, have other conversations about, hey, is this a better way of doing it? Or is this something we need to look at more closely? But that 4Ds is just, to me, is just genius.
No, what I like about it is it's the simplicity of it because there's no complication whatsoever. I don't know if I'm supposed to be talking about some of this stuff, but I was looking at some of the behind the door tech last night with Brent Sutton, and I'm pretty amazed with some of the technology piece that he's coming out with, but
cool.
maybe I'm letting the cat out of the bag too early. So sorry about that if I did that. So here's another question that came up. Talking about accountability by using the bus example from yesterday's presentation, had the worker not died, what would you do/say about not wearing the seatbelt? And they were talking about Sean Brady's presentation.
Yeah. So I think my philosophy, so if you think of that bus event, suppose the worker didn't die, it's a CIFP event, right? If no one got seriously injured or killed, it's a CIFP event. What I always advise people is treat a CIFP event as if it were a fatality.
Okay.
Because most of the time, we were just lucky it wasn't.
So when you say that in particular, what would you have them do inside of the organization? That way the listeners can have a better understanding.
Have them respond to it the same way they would respond if it was a fatality. Do whatever learning process you would use for a serious injury and fatality, whatever diligence you would put behind executing corrective actions and improvements and change management, you should do that for that event. Because, you know, if it happened once, it'll happen again. And we can't rely on being lucky to keep people from being seriously injured or killed. So just assume, and I have these conversations a lot, especially when I'm walking through a plant with a department manager or plant manager, and I see something that scares me, gets my attention. And I'll ask them about it, and they'll say something like, oh, yeah, we know we got that going on, but we got this project that's getting in the way, and we haven't quite figured out how to do that. And that's the question I always ask them. I said, if somebody got killed by that today, and they'll finish it for me. They said, yeah, we would figure it out tomorrow.
Figure it out tomorrow.
Do that.
And that project that we were working on that was so important, we would stop right at the moment. It's always interesting when you have somebody like yourself walk around a plant. It's almost like purposely they have one thing sticking out. That way you don't focus on the minor stuff at times, but at least it seems that way. Now, I got another one that came up, and this is the last one. It says, making mountain out of molehill. How can we change workers' perspectives on reporting incidents to encourage learning through investigations instead of avoiding it?
Two things. Make it very, very easy for workers to report things. One of the problems we found in Alcoa was for a worker to report a simple first aid case, I cut my finger, caused the supervisor about 45 minutes worth of work. And usually he had the worker sitting there next to him when he did it. And then you chase that up through the organization, the department safety coordinator. If I ask them, how much of your time on an average day is spent chasing down corrective actions from first aid cases and minor near misses, they'll tell me something like 60 to 70%. Stop that. Look at those data, make the reporting very, very simple. Look at the data for trends. If we're having a boatload of finger injuries, well, then there's something there we need to intervene. But stop, make the reporting process, make the investigation requirements very, very simple, very, very basic. Look for trends. Focus your big attention on CIFP events.
Okay. Now, I have a question because it was part of your presentation. you referenced something in particular that it's still shocking to me, and I just kind of want to further expand on it. When you went to that location that had the first aid kit that was being restocked by a vendor, tell me the whole process of what goes through your mind the moment you're finding all of this out. I know that you have very limited time when you're on the stage, but like, give me the detail. Like, because of the
context, we're this plant's getting a lot of scrutiny because they never report first aid cases, but about every 6 or 7 years they have a fatality. So we know something's going on there, right? So we're already, suspicious that there's something here that's not right. So when I see that, it's just like a light bulb moment. Okay, I got an idea of what's going on here now. And so I start talking to one of the EHS people about that. And that's where we had the conversation about, well, we bring the vendors in to restock it. And the employees really like this. And then we start having a conversation about their reward process, how they reward them for. And it was really, really in depth. Every person, crew, department, area, plant, 30, 60, 90, 120 days, the rewards got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then there was the punishment side. And so I can remember having a conversation with the plant manager about, which would you rather have? Would you rather report 50 first aid cases or one fatality? And, that's a no-brainer, right? I said, so what do you think's happening then? You're not reporting first aid cases. Every now and then you have a fatality. What do you think's happening? And, he knew. He said, we're just not hearing about stuff. So what are you going to do about it? And he said, well, we probably need to take away the reward program. I said, I wouldn't do that. I would change the things you incentivize. Mm-hmm. Instead of incentivizing people for not having injuries, incentivize people for reporting risk. Incentivize people for reporting where the controls aren't working or they're difficult to implement. Incentivize people for reporting, hey, I had a near miss. This machine's not doing what it's supposed to do. This guard's broken. And get rid of this thing about firing people, the two strikes and you're out, firing people. Because no matter how much positive incentive you have, if that negative consequence is there, they're not going to tell you stuff.
So once that conversation was had, how long did it take for the culture within the organization to change?
Long time. I don't think we totally got away from it until we changed plant leadership. Okay. New plant manager comes in from a different location, knows why he's being put there, and knows that his job is to overcome that situation and knows how to do it, Asked for all the help he needed, gave him a lot of resources, knew what his mission was. And it happened fairly quickly after that, but it took a change of leadership.
Okay. Well, Steve Scott, if people want to know more about you, where can they find more information about what you have going on?
Wow, you can find me on LinkedIn. You can shoot me an email at steve@hopimprovement.com.
Well, Steve, I appreciate you coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The views and opinions expressed during this broadcast, podcast, or radio show are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Safety FM and or Radio Big. The content discussed, including examples of analysis, is provided for illustrative purposes only. It should not be applied as the sole solution in real-world scenarios, as it is based on limited and dated open source information. Any assumptions made during this broadcast, podcast, or radio show are not reflective of Safety FM and or Radio Big. No portion of this broadcast, podcast, or radio show may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic, mechanical, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of Safety FM and or Radio Big. For permission requests, please contact Safety FM or Radio Big directly.